Tihi Mission Op Aesthetics 179. The consciousness that steadfastly contemplates only good, through all its diversified perceptions, may be said to have united its various parts into a pattern worthy to be designated beautiful. Cooperation only can be conceived of as beautiful. For competition must ever manifest as a grotesque absurdity. Only a propaganda-ridden world could possibly imagine war to be beautiful, and competition is merely a bloodless war in which the soul and not the body is slain. While contemplating the nature of the supreme good, the Neoplatonists of Alexandria also philosophized with rare lucidity upon the nature of the beautiful. Plotinus writes concerning the order of the beautiful as it emerges from the first beauty, and in the first rank we must place the beautiful and consider it as the same with the good, from which immediately emanate intellects as beautiful. Next to this we must consider the soul receiving its beauty from intellect, and every inferior beauty deriving its origin from the forming power of the soul, whether conversant in fair actions and offices, or sequences and arts. Lastly, bodies themselves participate of beauty from the soul, which, as something divine, and a portion of the beautiful itself, renders whatever it supervenes and subdues, beautiful, as far as its natural capacity will admit. Beauty, existing independent of form and as a divine principle, is likened to the fountainhead of existence, from which streams of beauty flow forth to permeate and beautify the whole inferior creation. Furthermore, the beauty of the inner nature greatly transcends the beauty of the outer, for the spiritual essences constituting the supersubstantial man, being more proximate to cause, partake more fully of the nature of cause, which is true beauty. Hence, as Plotinus also observes, there are those who, on perceiving the forms of gods or daemons, no longer esteem the fairest of corporeal forms. The quest of the truly beautiful is therefore identical with the quest of self, for self in its perfect and universalized sense. The all-pervading consciousness postulated by the sage is the perfect source of all beauty and therefore partakes in perfect measure of all that which is manifested from itself. That this supreme truth was taught by the sacred institutions of antiquity is further evidenced by Plotinus, who continues, just as those who penetrate into the holy retreats of sacred mysteries are first purified, and then divest themselves of their garments, until someone, by such a process, having dismissed everything for ein from the God, by himself alone, beholds the solitary principle of the universe, sincere, simple, and pure, from which all things depend, and to whose transcendent perfections the eyes of all intelligent natures are directed, as the proper causes of being, life, and intelligence. The Neoplatonists did not confine themselves solely to a theoretical consideration of mystical truths, they deemed it also essential that the disciple learn to actually partake of the very ties disclosed by intellectual contemplation. If perfect beauty was synonymous with perfect good, then the achievement of perfect participation in its effulgence was of first importance. As the ephemeral beauties of the outer, or material, world were sensed chiefly through the eyes, so the eternal beauties of the inner, or spiritual, world could only be sensed through a mystical perception which they termed the eye of the soul. We must enter deep into ourselves, again says Plotinus, and leaving behind the objects of corporeal sight, no longer look back after any of the accustomed spectacles of sense. For it is necessary that whoever beholds this beauty should withdraw his view from the fairest corporeal forms, and convinced that these are nothing more than images, vestiges, and shadows of beauty, should eagerly soar to the fair original from which they are derived. For he who rushes to these lower beauties, as if grasping realities where they are only like beautiful images ap. pairing in water, will doubtless, like him in the fable, by stretching after the shadow, sink into the lake and disappear. For by thus embracing and adhering to corporeal forms he is precipitated, not so much in his body as in his soul, into profound and horrid darkness, and thus blind, like those in the infernal regions, converses only with phantoms, deprived of the perception of what is real and true. While the Alexandrian mystics shared the Oriental attitude concerning the attainment of reality through rejection of the 180 lectures on Ancient philosophy. Tihi mission op aesthetics 181. Illusions of sense, they had more definite conclusions as to the method whereby the causal beauty was to be realized. Their instructions read thus: recall your thoughts inward, and if, while contemplating yourself, you do not perceive yourself beautiful, imitate the sculptor, who, when he desires a beautiful statue, cuts away what is superfluous, smooths and polishes what is rough, and never desists until he has given it all the beauty his art is able to effect. In this manner must you proceed, by lopping what is luxuriant, directing what is oblique, and by purgation illustrating what is obscure, and so continue to polish and beautify your statue until the divine splendor of virtue shines upon you, and temperance, seated in pure and holy majesty, rises to your view. To the ancients, aesthetics was not only the science of beauty, but that discipline whereby each individual in his quest for truth might elevate his own level of functioning so as to become luminous with the reflected light of universal beauty, and ultimately identical therewith. Two forms of beauty were postulated, that which is intrinsic to the nature of a body, and that which is extrinsic or communicated from some external source. In man, for example, beauty was the natural attribute of the spiritual nature, but the material nature partook thereof only by reflection, being a rational creature manifest ing through an irrational animal organism. Man has the capacity to recognize and estimate the excellence of order, symmetry, and grace, even as that which is base finds response in the baseness of the material nature, so that which is beautiful awakens a pleasant reaction in the rational part. As Bacchus was dismembered by the Titans and his parts strewn through out the irrational sphere, so the rational soul of man is scattered throughout the substances of his irrational animal nature. 2. The presence of this element of confusion is referable the inability to recognize or appreciate such soul qualities as harmony and beauty. The pleasurable sensation which beauty awakens in the beholder was said by the Greeks to arise from an internal symmetrical nature beholding an external body with qualities 182 lectures on Ancient philosophy. Iler to its own. As the internal nature dwells in perfect order, it thus rejoices in order and recoils from disorder. To a certain degree beauty is order, and as such is compatible with that internal orderliness which inevitably follows the liberation of rationality from the disorganizing effect of matter. Beauty rejoices in its own nature, and even the faintest shadow of it awakens a glad response. The infinite diversity of standards by which beauty is measured result from the various combinations of rationality and irrationality present in the soul. That which is beautiful to one is not necessarily beautiful to another. And yet beauty as a principle is common to all. We consider that to be beautiful which approaches most closely the symmetry of our own internal natures, and as the inner nature evolves more perfect harmonies, we become more discriminating in our responsiveness to external stimuli. Gradually symmetry of Form gives place to symmetry of thought, and the beauties of the inner nature are then revealed as surpassing the beauties of the outer form. The Neoplatonic theory of beauty may be summed up as the rationality of the beholder rejoicing in the evidence of R.A. Teonolidae in the thing beheld. Grace, symmetry, harmony, and order are unquestionable evidence of a rational consciousness. And we rejoice in this evidence to the same degree that we possess the ability to recognize them. That is most beautiful. Therefore, which elicits most perfect response from our inner perceptions. Through philosophy we ascend from that beauty communicated from an external source to the recognition of that beauty identical with source itself. Having ultimately attained through right thinking, right feeling, and right living to the condition of the beautiful within ourselves, with enraptured vision we can respond in perfect measure to the eternal beauty which flows from the inexhaustible fountain of the one good. In the present century, two great opposing systems of thought are struggling for supremacy. On the one hand is idealism, which declares that to be practical which is beautiful; on the other hand is realism, which asserts that to be beautiful which is practical. It is difficult to estimate the profound effect caused. The mission of Aesthetics 183. By this simple interchange of the words practical and beautiful, practicality must be interpreted to imply the greatest good to the greatest number, and there is no question that, if so interpreted, that which is of the greatest good to the greatest number is the beautiful necessity. However, we may well ask, if what we now term practical is actually fulfilling this ideal, much of the structure of modern civilization is revolting to the finer sentiments of humanity. Elbert Hubbard can hardly be censured for defining civilization as a device for increasing human ills, a machine for the perpetuation of the weak, an ingenious contraption for spreading disease and hunger. Men and women of vision all realize that modern civilization is doomed to collapse under the weight of its own infirmities. Like the mighty juggernaut, it is rumbling down the hillside of time to vanish ultimately in the veil of oblivion below. The reason civilization must crumble is because it is not beautiful, and lacking the order, harmony, symmetry, and grace which collectively constitute beauty, it will be disintegrated by the friction of its own individual parts. Like the scaled, fire-belching dragon of mythology, it is the jealous guardian of the tree upon whose branches hangs the golden fleece. Even today the Argonaut sets forth man in his quest for happiness, which alone makes life endurable, is determined, like Jason, to wrest the highest prize from the clutches of the monster he himself has created. The future dragon slayer is first born in the human soul as the spirit of revolt against the crushing weight of the artificial world which man in his folly has raised, Babel-like, to rival the glory of the heavens. Man has built a house whose bricks are made of mud and held together by slime. Indifferent to the laws of social architecture, he has raised this mighty edifice upon shifting sand, and now its walls of their own weight threaten to collapse about the heads of the foolish builders. Seated on their golden thrones, the titans of finance gaze down, like the huge stone Memnons of Egypt, upon a Davis Tate land. Like the pharaohs of the ancient Nile, their sandals are pounded from the golden crowns of vanquished kings.